Thank you for the invitation. As Sebastian already mentioned, it's on mapping class group actions on Hopf-Weitzschaber lattice models. This is recent work of my advisor and me, and my advisor Katrin and me. And I'm going to briefly explain the point from which we started. The starting point basically was the KITAF lattice model, which was originally developed by KITAF and from then on generalized by some other people. And the KITAF model has as ingredients a semi-simple finite dimensional Hopf algebra, let's say over a over the complex numbers, and a graph embedded on a surface. And the surface is oriented and possibly has a boundary. And from then, from that one obtains some structures. Firstly, a vector space of connections where you assign to every edge of the graph a vector of H. And secondly, you get excitations at the boundaries of the surface, which correspond to module structures over the Drinfeld double. And these module structures commute with one another. And from then one, from that one gets a topological invariant, which basically are the invariants of the action of the module structures. And this is sometimes called the protected space. And you get a projector from the total space to the protected space. And also, this was originally developed for quantum computing purposes. It's defined in such a general manner that it can also be applied in other areas. For example, it has relations to TQFTs. In particular, it's the two-dimensional parts, the surfaces of a extended Turalafiro TQFT. Okay, and what we did from this with this model is we generalized some aspects of it to not only to have more to so we generalized the semi-simple finite dimensional Hopf algebra to a pivotal Hopf algebra. And not only in the category of vector spaces over C, but to any symmetric monoidal category. This gives us vastly more examples than the original model, which has some very heavy restrictions on the data it can use. And with this model, we analyzed a toolkit of graph transformations. And with these graph transformations, we explicitly can give explicit expressions for the action of the mapping class group on this model. Okay. So now I'll explain all the preliminaries that you need to know for the actual results. So the first one is the mapping class group. If you take any surface with a boundary, the mapping class group simply is the are the diffeomorphisms of the surface relative to the boundary up to isotropy, meaning modulo the infinitesimally generated diffeomorphisms. Okay. And this mapping class group acts as symmetries for any structure that is that you can define on the surface up to isotropy. Okay. And an example of this would be the moduli space of flat connections. And relating to the model that we are looking at, we deal with graphs embedded on a surface. And after we embed the graph on the surface, the actual calculations we do only deal on the graph level and not on the surface level anymore. So after we've embedded it, we can forget the embedding. But actually, different embeddings would produce different results. And these are related by mapping class group actions. And just as an example, what elements of the mapping class group look like. They are, the mapping class group is generated by Dienfists around loops without essential self-intersections. For instance, if you take a look at this blue loop here, a Dienfist around a loop simply takes in a neighborhood of the loop and twists the neighborhood of the loop once around itself. Meaning that the, if you take a look what happens with this red circle here, if you twist it once around the blue circle, it's, well, after applying the Dienfist, this goes once along the blue circle after it goes back to itself. Okay. So, but in general, finding a set of generators and relations for the mapping class group is quite difficult. There are some relatively nice presentations one can deal with, and one of which is the following. For this, you take a surface with n boundary components and of genus G, and first you take a main torus here, and then you order the boundary components and the additional handles of the surface in a cyclic order. So you start with the first boundary component up to the nth boundary component, and then you take the first part of the handle here, the second part of the handle, and this gives you an order on these circles, on these boundary circles. Okay. So as I said, the mapping class group is generated by Dienfists, and in particular, it is generated also by these sets of twists, of loops. So the first set is the set of loops around each handle. So you get one loop around the main handle and G minus one loops around the other handles. And then you get curves separating one boundary circle from the next one, and also a boundary circle from the first circle of the handle, and so on. So these are two types of loops. And the third type of loop is the loop that encloses consecutive boundary circles, or consecutive boundary circles and handle circles. Okay. And so these generators were considered by Chavez, and he actually gave us a full set of relations for these generators. So the mapping class group can be presented by exactly the Dienfists around these loops with the following relations. I will not go into detail what these relations are, but just look at this search one here. This one relates all the Dienfists around all these loops on this red side, right part here, and is quite a complicated relation. So if we want to prove that the mapping class group acts on something, we can take this generating set of loops and define actions for them. And then we have to prove that all of these relations hold. And this is exactly what we did. Okay. So the next part that we need is the ribbon graphs. These are needed for the GitHub model. And these are graphs that are embedded in a surface. And after you embed them, you get an additional structure on them. Namely, you get an order of the edge ends at a vertex, like this here. So here, this vertex here has three edge ends, incident edges, and the order in which they appear at the vertex is actually important. So this order comes from the is basically the counterclockwise order of the background here. Okay, and so the after you embed a graph on the surface, you the components of the graph without the surface are the so-called faces of the graph gamma, and you can realize them as paths in the graph. And these look like this. You start at some point and always turn maximally left, and this then gives a path that looks like this until you reach the, reach the starting point again. Okay. And you can think of such an oriented graph, for example, as a triangulation. So an a triangulation is an example of such a graph. Okay. And in addition, if we these graphs can get quite complicated, so we want to arrange them a little bit more neat. And this can be done, for example, if you only consider one vertex, which you then can transform into a chord diagram like this, where you take some starting point at the vertex, which you in, which is indicated here by this dotted line, and then you replace this vertex with a baseline and order the edge ends like this. So, and an example of a ribbon graph that explains an arbitrary the arbitrary surface of genus G with n plus one or and n plus one boundary components is the following. So here you have n plus one boundary circles. We start with the first one here. Take a loop around each boundary circle. This one, the first one, corresponds to this loop here, and then up to n loops. And secondly, you get for each handle a pair of loops that then look like this. Okay. And in this picture, we only have one vertex, but we place additional vertices on the n plus one, on the n boundary components here, and connect them to this vertex, like this. And the last boundary component then corresponds, so every boundary component here corresponds to a face of this graph, and the last boundary component corresponds to the outer face. Okay, so this basically concludes the topological and graph theoretical part of the preliminaries. And the next one is the algebraic part, which is Hopf algebras. So first of all, we consider Hopf algebras in symmetric monoidal categories. Symmetric monoidal categories are categories in which you have a tensor product, and the order of the tensor product is material, so you can exchange how the tensor product is ordered. Okay. And you can think, for example, of vector spaces and with the usual tensor product of vector spaces, or of the category of sets with the Cartesian product of sets. These are the main standard examples. Okay. So in these symmetric monoidal categories, you can express morphisms by so-called string diagrams. And so parallel lines in a string diagram means you have a tensor product of different objects. So here you have you start with a tensor product of H tensor H. And then you go from top to bottom and obtain an element of H itself. Okay. And an Hopf algebra in such a symmetric monoidal category is first of all an object with a set of morphisms, which look like this. You have a multiplication that goes from H tensor H to H, a unit which goes from the tensor unit to the Hopf algebra. The tensor unit is in this setting is denoted by simply no line at all because it is trivial in the monoidal category. And so you have a multiplication and a unit. Then you have a dual version of that, which is a co-multiplication and a co-unit. And you also have a so-called antipode.
Don't you need a crossing element?
Excuse me?
You need a crossing element.
Yeah, that's the symmetricity. So the symmetricity of the monoidal category gives you a crossing, which doesn't discern between under and over crossing.
It's squares to one.
Excuse me? Yeah, it's squares to one. Yeah. Exactly. So that's. It's trivial in the sense that it's squares to one. So that's the most. It's a data of the category. Of the category, but not of the object itself.
At some point, you're going to have crossings. In fact, in the bottom, you do have a crossing.
Yeah, I do have a crossing, but that's a data of the category itself, not of the object of the category. So, So in a symmetric monoidal category, for example, the vector spaces, you have such a crossing for every two vector spaces, which is independent of the which isn't a data on the vector spaces itself, but is a natural transformation of the category. So for every such object in this category, you have a natural crossing. That's the point of the symmetric monoidal category. Shall I give an example or?
No, I'm just saying you can. The data is the next time.
So you have these morphisms, and these need to fulfill some conditions. The first identity here simply states that the multiplication is associative. The second here is that the unit is a unit for the multiplication. Then you have co-associativity, a dual concept of the associativity for the co-multiplication, and a co-unitality condition. These are the algebra and co-algebra axioms. And then you have Hopf algebra axioms. The first few here until this point here state that the algebra and co-algebra, that the algebra maps are co-algebra morphisms, and the other way around. And the last one here gives a condition on the antipode. But that's. That's an abstract definition, so we need an example. And the most basic example is the group algebra. So if you take any group, you can take the group algebra, which has as a basis the group elements. And the morphisms then look like this. The multiplication on the group elements is just the usual group multiplication. The unit maps a scalar to a scalar lambda to lambda times the unit in the of the group, and the co-multiplication is simply the diagonal map from the group to itself to the group times the group, and the co-units sends every group element to the unit of the field, and the antipode simply inverts every group element. And this antipode condition then translates to to the actually invertibility condition of the group. And here you don't actually need that you have a tensor product of vector spaces. You can do the same in the category of groups with the Cartesian product, in the category of topological spaces with the product of topological spaces. So these are further examples. Or if you take a Lie algebra, the universal enveloping algebra also has a canonical structure of a Hopf algebra. And if that Lie algebra is semi-simple and finite dimensional, there are ways to transform the universal enveloping algebra into Q-deformed universal enveloping algebra, which is infinite dimensional, or the restricted Q-deformed universal enveloping algebra at a root of unity, which is finite dimensional. Okay. So, but going back to this example here, we see that here the antipode squares to one, which is a really nice condition, but unfortunately, this doesn't always hold. So, for example, in these two, for these two Hopf algebras, this is not the case. But we can weaken this condition a little bit, and this weakened condition is a pivotal Hopf algebra. A pivotal Hopf algebra is a choice of additional morphism from the tensor unit to the Hopf algebra, which firstly satisfies these two conditions here. And these two conditions just state that it behaves like a group element in the group algebra. So if you go back for a second, here you see that the group element is mapped to two times itself, and applying the co-unit to it maps it to the unit of the field. And these are the first two conditions. And the second condition here is the actual is the more important condition. So you need all of them, but this one relates the antipode to the square of the antipode to the identity. Namely, it is just the antipode is conjugated to the identity by the element P. Okay. And with the help of such a pivotal morphism, you get an involution, which simply takes an element, applies the antipode to it, and then multiplies it from the left with the pivotal element. And examples of this include the group algebra. But now you here you see that the antipode is square to one. So, for example, already the unit element would be such a pivotal element for the group algebra, but also each other central element of the group. And also these other examples I gave before, the Q-deformed versions of the universal enveloping algebra, a pivotal of algebras, and the pivot element there is associated to the sum of the positive root. Okay. And other examples are involutive Hopf algebras, so where the antipode squares to one, or Ribbon-Hopf algebras, if you're familiar with that. Okay. So now we've gathered all our ingredients for the Hopf algebra model. The first one is a Ribbon graph, or a graph embedded in a surface. And the second one is a pivotal Hopf algebra in any monoidal category. And what we get from that is an object. Yes? And what? So a spherical structure gives you a pivotal one. That's
so is there just an extra condition you need to place on it for it to be spherical, or for a pivotal one to be spherical, or?
Yeah. So that's if I'm. Yeah, I don't have it.
It's a condition.
Please.
Yeah, I know how to translate it to the representation category. I know how to phrase
it. No, it's formulated as a condition on the representations. It says that when you consider like the traces of this kind of pivotal element in a representation, that this is for all representations satisfies a certain condition.
Oh, okay.
So we have these two ingredients, and then we totally analogous to the Kitov model, we get an object, which now assigns a copy of the Hopf algebra H to every label, to every edge of the graph, and analogous to the Kitov model, we get triangle operators. If you're not familiar with them, I'll explain them in a bit. And phase and vertex operators. And also, we get independence of the edge orientation. And this is the point where we actually need the pivotality of the model. So the edges in a ribbon graph are ordered, so they have an orientation. And if you want to if you want to reverse the order, you simply apply the involution defined by the pivotal structure to it. Can
you show the definition of theoretic?
Yeah, this is this one here. So you apply the involution T takes an element. Maybe I'll just write it in formulas. If you're in a vector space, for example, you just have this one here. So the pivotal element is, I define as P in our case. So
what is xi?
Excuse me?
It's an S.
S is the antipode. P times S. Yeah. Okay. And this is exactly this one here. OK? And yeah. So, okay. Here you get the independence of edge orientation with the involution. One could think of simply applying the antipode, but if the antipode is an involution, you actually get a non-trivial isomorphism if you want to flip the edge twice. Okay. So, I will now explain the structures we have on these. On this model, first of all, the triangle operators. Triangle operators are operators that act on an edge. So if we have an edge alpha, we get two H left module structures on the edge and two H left comodule structures. If you're familiar with the Kitov model, you usually have, instead of H left comodule structures, you have module structures over the dual of the Hopf algebra. And in the finite dimensional case, these can be translated into one another. But in the infinite dimensional case, this is the more natural condition.
Up to now, we didn't have any comodules.
Excuse me?
Up to now, we didn't have any comodules. So,
yeah.
The graph is only labeled by algebra.
Yeah, that's what I'm introducing right now.
So where are you introducing?
Excuse me?
Where are you introducing? Your graph is labeled by...
My graph is labeled basically by Hopf algebra elements, as in the Kitov model.
Yes. And?
And from the structures of the Hopf algebra, we get a module and comodule structure. And these... I'll explain.
That are colored by modules now?
No, they aren't colored by modules, but by the Hopf algebra. So, the Hopf algebra has a natural module and comodule structure over itself. And these are the structures that we obtain here. So, we get four such structures, one for each side of the edge, and one for the target edge end, and one for the starting edge end. The target edge end here simply is the left multiplication. So we get a module structure here, and this is the left multiplication of an element H with the label of the edge. And since we are working actually working in a symmetric monoidal category, we can express it as this.
Sorry, so where's the label A? So the H is labeled by an element H, and what is
so,
where is
okay.
A?
Yeah, yeah.
Labels now.
So we have this space H tensor E.
Yes.
So so for each edge alpha, we
is what?
Excuse me?
What is alpha?
The edge.
This is the these are the sets
alpha
of edges. Alpha is an edge, yes. Okay. And for any such edge alpha, we if we for a moment assume that we are working with a category over sets. So we have actual elements. For every such edge alpha, we can look at the component, which here is the element A that is assigned to the edge alpha. Okay? And then in another element H of the Hopf algebra can act on these on this element simply by a left multiplication. So this is the action associated to the target end. And the action associated to the starting end can be obtained by simply applying the involution to this edge. And then, so the involution T to this edge, then applying the action here and applying the involution again. So this gives us a condition on what this action should be, and it's the normal action one also has in the GitHub model, namely the action on the right by the element S of H. So apply the co-unit to it and then multiply it from the right.
Can you explain how to read these vertical line graphs?
Okay, so each line stands for any object in the category, and so if we have this blue line, let's say this middle one here, we denote the action of an element here. Let's take this right one here. This action here, we simply think of it as multiplication.
So the colored ones are edges.
Yeah.
And the black.
And the black one is the element acting, or the element one gets from the coaction.
So the black is H.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. Good. So.
It's part of the graph.
Excuse me?
It's part of the graph. So is it a new vertex here, or is it?
No.
Is it the new vertex, or it's already the vertex?
The black edge,
yeah,
you mean?
Black
no, it's not part of the graph. So it's basically you have the space H tensor E here, and then you on this space you get a module structure, which only acts on one edge of the graph and leaves all other edges invariant. The other edges stand for, so these lines here stand for all the other edges, okay? And secondly, so we've discussed the actions, then you also have a co-action, which is associated to the side of the graph. So for the left side of the graph, we simply take the co-action that was given by the co-multiplication, which takes an element alpha here and maps it to the co-multiplication of alpha, which we denote by Sweetler notation A1 tensor A2. And this again gives us the involution, again gives us a condition on what the action on the other side should be. And it turns out that this is the right co-multiplication, but now with the involution here, not with the antipode. So there's a slight difference in here. Okay. So these are the basic building blocks of the Kitav model, from which all other module structures and holonomies and so on are built. And the main important module and co-module structures are the vertex and face operators. The vertex operator simply takes an element h with which you want to act on the incident edge ends at a vertex, splits it up as many times using the co-multiplication as you have edges here, and then acts with the triangle operators associated to the front edge, so to the target edge or the starting edge end here. So for example, the element h1 acts on the red edge here by right multiplication of the antipode, by a sort of conjugation here on this violet edge, and so on. And you can also denote it like this. And the face operator basically is the dual version of that. So instead of edges, you now look at faces. For example, this face here.
So how are we deciding which one of the actions we use in the vertex operators?
So here, you have an action associated to the target edge and to the starting edge end. So and here, you this edge is outgoing, so it is only acted upon by the starting edge end action. The edge labeled with D is incoming, so it is acted upon with the target edge end action.
Purple edge gets acted on twice.
Yes, exactly. And and the order here, so you actually have an order here. This is you have to start at some point of the vertex here and then go counterclockwise. And this order here is indicated by the psyllium. And this is just another condition on the graph.
So the vertex operator is labeled by H.
So the vertex operator takes H and acts on the whole space of edges.
And the face operator is not, there's no input for
it. No, the face operator is dual to that, basically. So in the original Kitav model, there would be an action of the dual of the Hopf algebra, of the dual space. And here, this is just translates then into a co-action. So you take a, again, you start at some point.
Can I ask
yes?
Question?
Yeah.
So the vertex operator is a gauge transformation.
Yeah, basically, exactly. So the vertex operators are.
And the face operator is a projection on the flatness.
Not a projection on the flatness. The face operators basically give you the curvature of a face.
Okay, so it measures the curvature.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so you again, you start at some point here, and then you go maximally left, and you gather up all these co-module structures. So for every edge you traverse here, you either traverse it on the left side or the right side, or on both of them. And then you take the co-action that you get. For example, the first edge you get here is the B1 part here. Then you get a co-action of D1. Then you get the other co-action, which is T of D3. And you gather up all these parts and multiply them together in the order you traverse them. So that's the output, yes. And I'll show a short example for the group case. This is exactly what, so in the group case, this simplifies quite a bit. So an element H simply acts by the inverse, inverse if the edge is outgoing, or by the element itself if the edge is incoming. And the phase operator then simply takes all the edges it traversed, depending on the direction it traversed them, and multiplies the elements together. But since we have a non-trivial pivotal structure here, so if we take a pivotal structure on these edges on the group that is not a trivial one, meaning it depends on some central element, we additionally get a term p to the power of 3 here for each edge we traverse in the inverse direction. Okay. So in this, if this one, say if p is equal to 1 and this one is cancels to the unit of the group, then you would have a flat phase, for example. And otherwise, you simply don't. And this is this example for a non-trivial pivotal element is something that is usually not considered. So this actually gives us a new structure that we consider even for such simple things as groups. Okay. And okay, now we basically have all the ingredients together that I can state our main theorem. And just as a quick reminder, we have this graph here that describes the surface of genus G with n plus 1 boundary components.
Do you mind if we, before we go on, I have another question?
Yeah, of course.
If you have a non-trivial P, is there a geometric interpretation of, like, usually you think of this flatness condition as a flatness thing, but if you have this non-trivial P,
yeah,
what's the geometric interpretation?
The answer is I'm not totally sure. But you could think, so maybe it's instead of, so it gives us a different condition of flatness, basically. You can, for example, you can now think that a phase should be flat when this condition here holds. When this here, so when all this here is equal to 1. But I'm not sure if this is the right interpretation.
So if he comes how many
edges are traversed in the inverse direction.
So it's not really orientation independent?
Yes, it actually is, because the way you orient these edges into a different direction, you get an additional p. So if you, so just as an example here, if you have an edge like this and you traverse it from this on the left, let's say this is labeled of A, you get an element A1 and then the edge is labeled with A2. Shall I restrict to the group case? Maybe then this is A and A. Okay, but if you now flip, so this is oriented like this, not so good. If you instead flip the edge and traverse it from this direction, you now have T from A, and now the you get a different coaction, and the coaction then gives you again the same element A, but this edge here stays with the T from A. So this still is independent of the orientation. This is exactly the way the triangle operators are defined. Okay. Does that answer your question? So. Okay, so again, as a reminder, we have this graph which describes the surface of James Chi with n plus one boundary components. And yeah, this is so all these cycles are a set of generators of the fundamental group. And using these, one can push any loop on the graph onto the graph on the surface onto the graph. Sorry. And from this we get an action, which I'll explain after I state our main result. So for any such pivotal Hopf algebra, we get an action of the mapping class group on this graph here. And this action additionally commutes with the vertex and phase operators. Okay. So this is a naturality property, basically, that any such action should be subject to. So, And also, we will only define the action for this specific graph. We can also extend our action to a much more, to any graph that has a pairing of vertices and faces. And so we are not very restricted on the types of graphs we consider. Additionally, the action of the mapping class group now explains how different abendings of the same graph, let's say this one, onto the surface are related to one another. And since we have taken a pivotal Hopf algebra in any symmetric monoidal category, we get a much greater pool of examples for this action. For example, if we take a group in the category of sets, or say a Lie group in the category of smooth manifolds, and take as a pivotal element the unit of the group, we get back the action of the moduli space of flat connections after we factor out the vertex operators. And so this unifies several series, or at least the Kitaev model with this one, and maybe some more. And we can give explicit formulas for the action of the Dehnquists. And these are done in terms of graph transformations. And this is what I will now dedicate the rest of the talk to. So to explain the graph transformations and how they produce the action of the mapping class group. Okay. So the first graph transformation is a simple sliding move. So if you have two adjacent edges, say an edge, the red edge and the blue edge here, you can slide the blue edge around here, the left side of the edge, and this, first of all, gives a graph transformation, but this graph transformation acts on the labels of the graph. So, and it acts on the labels in quite a natural manner. Namely, you take the commutative structure of the left side of the red edge and apply it and act with that on the with the moduli structure of the target edge and of the blue edge here. And then you gain this thing here. And this light is invertible. Here you only have to take the inverse of the antipode to go the other direction. And for the other orientations of the edges, so there are six more of such sliding moves, depending on whether you slice a starting edge end or an outgoing or a target edge end, or on which side of the edge you slide, you get different sliding moves. And these are all related by the involution T. Okay. And this graph transformation has a really nice property. Namely, it commutes with the face and vertex operators of the graph, which are so they don't change the curvature, and they commute with gauge transformations. There is a slight condition on that, namely, you cannot slide over the starting points of the, so going back here, you have a starting point for the vertex operators and for the face operators. As long as you do not slide over these starting points, you get a commutation relation. And now, as an example, the group case, again, it's quite simple. The sliding move simply multiplies from the left of the element you are sliding along, and the inverse sliding move then multiplies with the inverse of this element. Okay. So, with this simple move, we can already produce a mapping class group action for the torus with zero or one boundary components. And for this, I will first explain what the mapping class group of the torus looks like. So you have two different cases here where you have one boundary component. The description of the mapping class group is quite simple. Namely, it is the red group on three strands. So it is generated by two elements, A and B, and together with the relation that ABA is the same as BAB. And if you now take the mapping class group of the torus without a boundary component, this you get an additional relation on the generators, namely that the product of ABA to the power of 4 squares is the identity. And these generators here act can be identified with the Dean twists around a set of generators of the fundamental group. So the Dean twist around the blue edge here is the element B, and the Dean twist around the red edge is the element A. Okay. So, and this also, so this picture also gives us a ribbon graph for this, for the torus. And this ribbon graph then looks like this. When you take the quad diagram of the ribbon graph, and I will now restrict myself to the group case, but this all holds generally. So the vertex operator here simply conjugates both of these loops with an element h. And the phase operator takes a commutator of a to the minus 1 and b. But since we do take a non-trivial pivotal element, we also get a p squared for the minus 1 part c. And the Dean twists are then simply defined in terms of sliding moves. So the Dean twists are around the edge labeled with B is simply the sliding move that takes the edge that is the edge end that is enclosed by the loop B. So this target edge end of the blue edge in the middle, and slides at once from the right side to the left side along the loop B, giving us this transformation here, simply multiplying with the element B on the blue edge. Okay. The same thing then applies to the Dean twist around the edge labeled with the element A. Here we slide again the edge enclosed, the edge end enclosed by the blue edge along this loop, and get the multiplication of B with A to the minus one from the right. And again, these transformations commute with the phase and vertex operators. And so I have now defined these dangers, but this alone, of course, does not suffice. So we actually have to prove the relations. And I'll just give these short formulas for what happens here. So if you take BAB or ABA, this produces the same result. It transforms the edges here like this. And so you exchange, basically, A and B, invert A, and then conjugate the A to the minus 1 with B. And for the fourth power of this, one gets the following formula, that this gives a conjugation with an element. And the element can, for some reason, can be obtained by the curvature of the phase. So the phase operator here, and then applied, and then apply the involution T, and then you conjugate each edge with this, meaning you take a gauge transformation here. Okay, and this gives you the following formula for the fourth power of this element of the mapping class group, namely that you have a conjugation with the conjugator up to the pivotal element here. And yeah.
I was going to ask, do you in general only expect the action to be defined on the ground space or whatever of the, maybe that's a bad way to say it, but like when you're defining the TQFT, you expect the actual topological part just to be the ground state space?
So we are defining the action for the excited state. So we get an action for the excited state, so for basically you can think of it as an you have a action of the mapping class group with boundary components. For so you have one boundary component for every excited state. If you lose a boundary component by having a flatness condition and an invariance condition, there are some cases, namely the semi-simple finite dimensional one, where this then gives us back an action of the mapping class group with one component less. So there's a topological interpretation here. Namely, here we see, so this element doesn't always act trivially, but we need it to act trivially to get an action of the mapping class group with zero components. So in general, we always get an action of the mapping class group with one components, but on the but for example on the invariance, where here the commutator is just a unit, and P is a central element, this then gives a trivial action here, meaning that this here actually then gives the identity, and therefore an action of the mapping class group with zero boundary components.
And in this case, do the co-invariants span the ground state space, or is it something different?
No. The ground state space is actually smaller than the co-invariants. So it's the co-invariants and the invariants under the vertex action. So the
So these things which are in the co-invariance, which are not part of the ground state space, is there an interpretation of those states? Like you said that the ground state was inside the co-invariance. Is there?
So the ground state of the Kitav model is, you can think of that as the connections with curvature zero. That's also, but up to gauge invariant, gauge invariance. So
so
get a
states which are not necessarily have zero curvature.
So the zero curvature condition is one of the conditions, and the other is gauge invariance. So you need an element of the ground state needs to have both conditions.
And co-invariants are just flight.
Yeah, co-invariants are just flight. Exactly. So, but this flatness condition is the right picture for the semi-simple case.
Okay.
With trivial pivotal element. I'm not sure what the right interpretation is for the for the general case here. Okay. So this basically is the one of the most basic examples of this action. So in principle, one can define a Dienfis by sliding all the by sliding the edge ends that are inside of a loop along this loop. So, but not all generators of the mapping class group are such loops. And that is why we also need another graph transformation. And this is the graph transformation of adding an edge. And so if we have any path here in this graph, which say turns maximally left but isn't always closed, we can get an we can add an edge to this graph, starting at the starting point of the path and ending at the ending point of the path, and this again gives us an basically a homomorphism of the state space. And the condition we get for labeling this new edge is basically a flatness condition. So the condition is that the new face that we've just created here is now flat. So it's a co-invariant of the face operators. And
again, just increase the space this axon is like h to the number of edges, right?
Does
adding an edge change your space rectangle?
Gives us a new space, but it gives us the subspace. The image is in the subspace of where you have co-invariants under the phase operator of this new phase. And just for an example here, in the group case, you actually just can label the new edge with the product of the group elements that you, of the edges that you've traversed. So this procedure, again, commutes with any face and vertex operators as long as you do not traverse them with this edge gamma. This path gamma. And we can also delete these edges again to get back the original state. And this can be done by simply applying the co-unit to the edge we've just introduced. And for the group case, this looks like this. So this I've already explained. And if we have an element C here on this edge, we just delete it and yeah, that's that. Okay. So this now gives us an action of, so now I can explain how general Dehnquists act. So if we take some path in the surface, we can translate it to a path in the graph by simply pushing it towards the graph. And in, if this path already is a loop, we can twist along the loop by simply sliding every edge inside of the loop from right to left once along the loop, which in this case gives us something like this, where we take the element B and act with this element on all of these elements inside here. And in the group case, this looks like this. Here we just conjugate loops that are inside it with the element B, or act from the right or left with the element B or B inverse, depending on whether the edges are incoming or outgoing. And for general paths in the graph, we just replace them with a loop and then apply this procedure and delete the paths again. Okay, and this concludes the talk. If you have any questions, feel free to ask them, and thank you for the attention.
Any further questions? So let me start. You didn't tell us what is your motivation for sentences. So
okay.
You don't have to give a physical motivation, but maybe a
mathematical motivation. So my main motivation is to understand how the how different embeddings of the graph give different results in the GitHub model. So, and these embeddings are related by simply by simple mapping class group actions, and also so you have the different morphisms of the graph, and you should expect an action of the different morphisms on the graph on any structure that you have on the graph, for example, the GitHub models. And what we did is actually compute the structure. And we also, as you see, get quite explicit expressions for this for these actions. And yeah, that's the main motivation.
So this could also mean that if you want to deform one of these paths that you've drawn on, like the torus that you want to know.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Further questions?
Yeah.
It may not be fair, but in the sort of more standard cases where you have like a semi-simple Hopf algebra, you have a three-dimensional field theory. And one of the things, if you knew how the mapping class group acts on the ground states, especially on surfaces, you can use that to compute the partition function on three manifolds from a Hegart splitting. Like if you know the state you get from the standard handle body, then you can relate a general from a general Hegart splitting. You just need to know the mapping class group actions. Do you think that could allow you to define partition functions for much more general inputs besides just semi-simple Hopf algebras, but you know, these pivotal and more general settings?
I'm not sure how the semi-simplicity goes into these partition functions. So I'm not totally sure of that. But you, so yeah, no, I'm can't really answer that. So maybe.
What I could say for this is there's Cooper-Perkin invariance. And recently there was some work by Berelissier and Kashaev that have defined this also in a much more general setting. So the standard setting is okay if you have a finite dimensional semi-simple Hopf algebra over C, everything is going to work, but it's slightly boring. But Berelissier and Kashaev have defined this abstractly also for Hopf algebra in a symmetric monoidal category, but with some additional conditions that resemble the stuff on the partial traces. And partial traces were also used by other people to try to kind of generalize topological quantum field theories to non-semi-simple settings. So you would guess that kind of, if one can understand the precise relationship of this and of the work Turaev and Kashaev and Berelissier, that one could do it in that way. So they need more condition than we need, but that is to be expected because mapping class group action is much simpler than LTQFT. But this is kind of a research project question, not something one can quickly see.
Any last question? That's from the case, let's thank Thomas again.